In studio with me is a former radio disc jockey, now a novelist. His name is Steve Bellinger. His first novel, his first published novel, is called The Chrono Card, a science fiction tale set in Bronzeville, set across more than a century. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Explain to people how you're a former radio guy. You got that. Very few people wear the headphones in here because I don't take phone calls.
Oh, absolutely.
You go, hey, wait a minute, Rick. I'm a former radio guy. I'm wearing headphones.
Well, I'm an alum of IIT, and so I did radio on WIIT for 4 years.
What kind of show?
All kinds of show. I mean, there weren't very many black students there then.
Yeah.
So I had the only soul.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, it was very popular. In fact, I got an award for that 1 year.
That's fabulous. You should get an award for this book, too. What took you? I know that your mom, Dorothy Bellinger, you grew up on the Near West Side, was a big reader and would bring books home to you. That's what first turned you on to literature, right?
Exactly. Yeah, she worked for a printing company, and she would bring home books and magazines, just sort of all sorts of things. And I picked up a copy of iRobot, Isaac Asimov, and fell in love with sci-fi at that point.
Wow. Yeah. How old were you? 12-ish?
Probably something like that. I don't even remember. Old enough to read.
But you also fell in love with writing, and it's been, you know, decades before this first novel came out. What kind of writing did you do before that?
Oh, everything I could. I mean, I did comic books. I wrote Sunday school lessons for the AME Church for 5 years.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did. I did original radio drama. I wrote and produced radio drama back in the '70s.
Wow.
And in fact, there is a production entitled Day of the Martians that I did, which is a modern version of War of the Worlds that takes place in Chicago.
Was most of your writing, I don't think the Sunday school stuff was, but most of your writing was science fiction based then, right?
Yeah, when I could do fiction. I mean, I did some like newspaper articles for like small newspapers and things like that. Yeah.
When you got in the high tech field, I mean, you go to IIT, you deal in the world of technology, right?
Well, you know, you've seen the movie Hidden Figures.
Yes, of course.
Well, that's the computer that I worked on back then. In fact, I recognize the Fortran book.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Wow. What then is the seed of the Chrono Card, which you can't – I'm going to spell that for you people. C-H-R-O-N-O-C-A-R by Steve Bellinger. When did you sit down and say, okay, it is time for me to try my hand? You may have had maybe novels, bits and pieces of them before, but the seed of this one, what compelled you to sit down and start writing?
I had always wanted to write the great American science fiction novel.
Hmm.
And I sort of like time travel.
Yeah.
And it dawned on me that I should use my own experience, you know, so the character should be black. And that it should take place in my hometown, Chicago.
Let me ask you, as a science fiction person, I'm not a big science fiction guy, though I loved your book. Are there many African-American characters in science fiction? My guess would be no.
Well, not really. And very often, if you watch a lot of the movies, you know, you may see an African-American captain of a starship.
Yeah,
well,
right.
Well, nothing to do with the actual black experience, so to speak.
See, exactly.
So that's where I tried to be different here.
You said it. Well, let's before we talk about your writers' groups and all that stuff and all the thing, the novel is set in the past. It is about the son of a slave.
Right.
Who goes to the Tuskegee.
Tuskegee, yeah. He has the mind of a genius.
Yeah.
He goes to Tuskegee and in kind of a sneaky way gets a PhD in physics. And he figures out the secret to time travel. He designs a chrono car, which he cannot build, doesn't have the technology. So he publishes it in a very obscure journal.
Sure.
And then 125 years later, a black IIT student discovers these plans and builds a chrono car. Well, where are you going to go the first time?
The great thing is his purpose in building the chrono car, because he's an IIT student, he wants to experiment and do this very thing. But he wants to time travel to a very specific point.
Well, he wants to show the machine off to his inventor.
Yeah. See, that's... That plot twist, and it's not a plot twist, that plot thread is really fascinating to me.
Oh,
so
wow. Okay.
This kid, as you told me before, and I'm not giving too much away, is kind of The book's not autobiographical, but the kid is kind of based on you.
Oh, yeah, kind of based on me.
In what ways?
Well, when I set up the situations, I would ask myself, well, what would I do then? You know, I was kind of, you know, he's a little careless. You know, being from a very humble beginnings, sure. I built my own stereo, for example.
Wow.
You know, I would teach myself how to fix things. I fixed a tape deck once, took it apart, fixed it, put it back together, worked perfectly, and there's still a couple of screws and springs on the floor there, but it still worked.
Well,
he's that kind of a character. He gets it to work, but he hasn't done enough research to know what trouble he's getting into.
Well, but also what's also appealing about this kid is he's curious.
I mean, exactly.
He is hungry and curious for knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. So he goes back to the year 1919 in Bronzeville. It was called the Black Belt. And because he figures out that's where you can find the now Dr. Johnson. He also meets, his daughter.
Of course.
And
he
gets into trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have to do Steve Bellinger? You didn't grow up in Bronzeville. You didn't grow up in the Black Belt. That neighborhood has changed remarkably over the last, 40 or 50 years.
Oh, sure.
When you did do the research, what did you think? And I'm sure, obviously, you did a ton of research.
Well, yeah, I've worked in that area for a long time.
Yeah. And IIT is in that area.
But I walked up and down 47th Street several times just to get a feel of what it was like. And I realized that a lot of those buildings were there in 1919.
Sure.
You know, one of the interesting chapters in the book is when she's showing him around and he recognizes the elevated train.
Yeah.
And she's amazed that you've gotten no farther than that. You know?
Yeah. 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 You haven't. Yeah. They're not flying cars.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
This book. Well, let's take a break. Let's take a quick break and come back. I'm sitting here with Steve Bellinger talking about his first of what should be a stream of novels. The first one is called The Chrono Car, Chron OCAR. It's a really handsome book. The design of this cover is really cool.
Oh,
Who did this?
His name is Michael Leadingham. He's an award-winning artist.
It is published by, what's the publisher here?
Barking Rain Press.
Barking Rain Press out of Vancouver, Washington. It's a handsome book, and it's the
if
other
I can
reason
say
I,
a shout-out to Sherry Gormley and Ty Locke. Those
shout
are
out to
people.
Whoever you want.
Yeah, those are the two ladies that made all this possible.
Well, it's a handsome book, and it's set in Chicago, and it's as you know, you regular listeners, I'm not a great fan of science fiction, but when I come across something that it's incredibly clever. And it's not goofy. It's not goofy science fiction, Steve Bellinger. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Mr. Bellinger. That's a piano of Alan Barkus by popular demand. I played him last week, and a lot of you wanted to hear him again. You'll hear a couple songs at the end when we check in with producer Elise Graham and see what her new job is. She's always got something going. I have some more time, though, with Steve Bellinger, the author of a fascinating book, The Chrono Car, Chronocar, about a contemporary young man named Tony Carpenter, who finds the plans for this time travel machine that were initially invented after the turn of the century, and decides to go back to build it, go back, meet the guy who invented it, so he can emulate him. He obviously admires him for building something like this,
yeah,
and also meet his very, very cute daughter, but also get involved in the horrific race riots of 1919 in Chicago,
yes.
And they were horrific. Steve, define, if you would, science fiction. It's a broad umbrella, yes?
Well, actually, the definition that I believe in is actually sort of narrow. Real science fiction would be stories in which the science, whether real or imaginary, is so central to the story that if you removed it, you would have nothing.
Oh,
now, by that definition, Star Wars is not science fiction.
Good point.
Even Lucas would tell you that himself.
Yeah, interesting.
And this is sort of what I consider to be hard science fiction. I mean, in that it deals with a little bit of real science adding up to, coming up to the fictional science.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised at how many people really enjoy it. But I think most people don't realize what real sci-fi is.
Yes, good point. So. Good point. I may not either. You're right. You're right. I just enjoyed this as a good novel that happens to travel back in time.
Oh, great.
And has a machine in it mm-hmm. that I couldn't come to event if I wanted to. When you first finished this book, what did you think? Did you think, wow, I have a real great book on my hands? You didn't, did you? 'Cause you...
Well, I thought, okay, I got something. It might work out. My wife picked up a copy of one of the early manuscripts. She read it and came to me in tears saying that if I didn't finish the thing and send it off, she's going to divorce me.
I know. You say that in the acknowledgments.
Yeah, so that's called motivation.
Yes, and you say, thank you, sweetheart.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No kidding. How hard was it to when you joined writers' groups, did you not? Did you join them when you were writing this?
Well, not in the beginning. When I sent the manuscript off to the publisher the first time, I got a nice long rejection letter because they saw the potential of the story.
That's fantastic. That so rarely happens.
It was unbelievable. And she recommended that I join writers' groups to learn how to develop characters and what have you. And in the book there,
it was a real letter of encouragement. It must have been.
It was.
An empowerment.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I knew I had something going.
Yeah.
And I thanked the members of that group, in the book. Now, I'm a member of the writer's group now. It's called the Novelist Meetup. Mm-hmm. And they helped me with my second and third novels, which are,
in the process published.
And if I could shout out to Barry, sure. Bex, Bill, Maria, Amanda, Alicia, Catherine, and Gina.
No, you can't do that.
I can't.
On this show.
Okay.
What are you crazy? Why are you doing something? Of course.
I take it all back.
Just joking. Shout out to anybody you want, because those groups, and there are a lot of them around, literally take away the inherent insecurity that I think any first time novelist feels.
Absolutely. I mean, to have someone read your work and tell you that it has value. Even when they find things too that need work, that need to be corrected, but it has value. This is great. You're on the right path. And maybe it'll even make a suggestion here and there. I mean, there was someone made a suggestion once for the Chronicar, and I went home thinking, the guy's an idiot. Then I did it and realized it was perfect,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How hard was it to get the book published? Because the publishing business, as you know, is pretty wicked these days.
See, my life has been kind of strange. Because a lot of people will tell you that they've sent it off to 30, 40 people.
Yeah.
I sent it to one publisher, and after not hearing, I wrote to them, and it turned out that the principal of the company had died and mm-hmm. weren't doing anything, so I left that alone. I sent it to these guys, and I got that rejection letter. I sent it to another publisher that actually turned out to be a vanity press.
Yeah, well, I know what that is.
So I thought,
maybe you pay us, and we'll publish your book.
And I thought, well, maybe I'll go that route if no one else wants it. And because actually Barking Rain Press is like the third place I sent it to.
That's fantastic.
But I did my research. There's a website called duotrope.com
mm-hmm.
where you can actually search independent publishers based on all sorts of criteria. And they matched my criteria. And, they were like, they've been around maybe 2 years then. They were looking for writers. They only had one other science fiction book. I don't think they had any black writers at the time, so it was just a perfect storm.
Wow. And you've done a lot of – first of all, when they sent you that first copy and you held it in your hands, how did you feel?
I cried like a baby. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was unbelievable.
No, I'm sure you did.
I reacted that way when I saw the cover the first time they sent it to me, because that's what made it real.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you're pretty actively marketing social media-ing.
Oh, yeah.
Thing. You've realized that's one of the huge new aspects of the publishing biz.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And part of this is is sort of a bucket list kind of thing. I work downtown, and mm-hmm. I had always dreamed of doing a book signing at Barbara's at the Willis Tower.
Oh, wow.
And I managed to do that like a month before it closed.
Yeah.
I'm working with another gentleman, Joe Rooley. He did.
Yeah,
the,
this sounds like. How did you two pair up, Joe?
Well, another writer.
Joe Rooley is the author of the Chicago Haymarket Affair. How did you two pair up?
It's another writer's group. And he had written this. I had written the Chronicar, and we were just talking about it because he was going around trying to do programs. And they were all saying, well, this is great, but we need something different. And I forget if it was he or I that came up with the idea, but the combination turned out to be magical. And
so you talk about the history. I mean, he is obviously running, but a very real event.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And mine is based on real events.
Exactly.
So we talk about the research, you know, what's real, what isn't real, and how to figure out who's telling the truth.
Your wife's also a writer, isn't she?
Yeah. Well, she's a business coach. She's working her heart out right now. And she wrote a book entitled "You Lost Me at Hello."
Yeah,
and
actionable principles that move you beyond networking. Her name is Donna Smith Bellinger,
and she teaches people how to do exactly that.
Now, did she cry when she saw your book?
I don't know because I was too busy crying.
Yeah. I couldn't see through the tears.
See, exactly.
Donna, where are you? I can't see you. This whole experience, obviously, Steve Bellinger has empowered you tremendously.
Oh, absolutely.
Did it make the writing of your second and third novels that much easier?
Yeah. I mean, the Chronicar took 7 years of messing around and researching and putting it away and picking it up. The second book took year and a half. The third one
took a week.
Like 8 months. Yeah.
A week.
Yeah, exactly.
Are they both science fiction as well?
Yeah, they're all science fiction.
Set in Chicago.
Set in Chicago is sort of a series. The second one is entitled Edge of Perception, and a lot of that action takes place on Goose Island.
Really? Is it a series with Tony Carpenter?
No, he's not in it, but it's in that same universe.
Yeah.
Because the fourth novel, which I'm working on now, is the actual sequel and conclusion to the Chronicar.
Oh, how interesting.
And when I do that, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do after that.
What do you mean? You'll be rich and famous. George Lucas will be making movies about this.
Well, you know, it beats all of the remakes they're doing in the movies now. We were just at the theater, and they're remaking Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, I mean, they have no idea. Hollywood has no idea.
You know, I mean, I know the ending. Why would I go see it?
They have no ideas. Yeah. Who inspired, what authors? I mean, you go back to, you know, Isaac Asimov and some of your early influences. What authors inspire you?
Well, again, it's those guys, Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke, Ray Bradbury. Some of the newer authors like Orson Scott Card, mm-hmm. I like some of his stuff, Harlan Ellison.
Sure,
but
sure.
I try to develop my own style, so I have to be careful.
I can't
read a lot of stuff when I'm writing
because
it starts to sound like their stuff.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
The first short story that I wrote in college, the guy said, "This is great, but it sounds like 2001 A Space Odyssey," you know.
Well, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, that's true. But
Steve, you seem so pleased and empowered, and you've got your own website, which is Steve Bellinger. I'm not even going to insult you people by spelling that for you. It's Steve Bellinger, okay, .com. It's a good website.
Exactly.
It's a nice website.
You can also get to it at thechronicar.com also.
See, you're a good marketer. You
oh,
know
yeah.
what you know.
Well, I used to be
doing.
A web developer, so I did all that stuff.
You got any events coming up?
Yes, as a matter of fact. We talked about the event that I'm doing with Joe Rooley.
Yeah.
We just finished doing one at at 57th Street Books
great.
Bookstall in Winnetka. On July 15th at 5, we're going to be at the bookseller on Lincoln Avenue.
Oh, good. Have you ever been there?
Yeah, I was there once before.
The bookseller's a great start
because
you can have wine and beer while you're listening to you and Joe talk.
And then at 2 o'clock on the 29th of July, we're going to be at the Edgewater branch of the Chicago Public Library.
That's fantastic.
So we've got other things coming up, like later in the month. We're going to.
Well, you can find it all. You've got a good website, too. Well, you should because you're an IIT
Well, I better,
guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you better have one. But, ladies and gentlemen, watch for Steve. I'm going to have Steve and Joe on the show probably by the time your next book is out.
Yeah, hopefully,
but to do your thing and your history thing here, you sound like a great team.
Sure.
And you, my friend, are a terrific writer.
Thank you very much.
The book is The Chronicar. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, Chronicar.
Chronicar.
You have no idea what it is to hear that from you.
What? Oh, stop that. It's just a cool cover, and it is one of the few, and I think this is a very important thing to introduce African-American characters to science fiction in a new way, and Chicago-based science fiction, too, which is great because it's history.
Exactly.
And your history is well-founded and grounded. Steve, it's a pleasure to get to know you.
Thank you, sir.
I'll see you in a few months.
Okay.
I'll see you in a few months. You
Terrific.
And Joe will sit here, and you'll say, Joe, put the headphones on. I used to be in radio. Greg Borzo and I talked about his book, Chicago's Fabulous Fountains, earlier, a couple months ago or 6 weeks ago when I was filling in for John Williams before, or whoever I was filling in for. Maybe it was Memorial Day, and I just was so taken with the book. And I've always admired Greg, who is one of Chicago's best writers, that I said, he's got to come back on. He's written the Chicago L and Chicago Cable Cars. The latest is Chicago's Fabulous Fountains. Greg, how are you?
Doing great. Thank you. Good. It's good to talk to
well,
you.
Well, but it was fun. It was fun when you were on, and I thought to myself, my God, it's the weather is so nice. There would be nothing better to do than, frankly, like stick your head in a fountain. But your book was such a revelation to me because it chronicles more fountains. No one has ever picked up this book, have they, Greg Borzo, and said, oh, I know all those fountains.
Well, they think they know Chicago fountains because they know Buckingham and Crown and one that's close to their house. But when they look at the book, they're surprised because we have 135 and counting outdoor public fountains in Chicago.
Greg, were you yourself surprised when you started this project at how many there were? Because I frankly am.
I was very surprised. Initially, I was going to do a book about fountains across the country, but then I started to do some research and some kicking around town and found so many here, I just had to focus on Chicago with so many. Now, they're not all majestic.
Right.
But most of them are pretty interesting.
Well, see, you got a point, and I think we're a little spoiled, don't you think, because we are all, yes, we have Buckingham Fountain, yes, we have the Crown Fountain, and they are both amazing fountains, but in the kind of what I like about the book so much, and it's, I've read it about three times and certainly looked at the pictures about 1,000 times, there's a real kind of intimacy to some of these fountains that almost in a way make certain neighborhoods, don't you think?
You're right. For example, the fountain up at Lincoln Square, at Giddings and Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a plaza there, and it acts as a magnet for people to come to sit in that little square and get to know their neighbors better. Families, kids, entertainers come, and that fountain is the main reason they gather there.
You know, and some of them, and you do such a remarkable job on many of these fountains were first built as kind of utilitarian items, not merely decorative. I think, you know, I think of one, a more recent one, one of my favorites is that crazy, beautiful, though, turtle fountain in Gowdy Square Park on the near north side in one of the nicest neighborhoods in the world. It doesn't function as a fountain anymore, but it's adorable, isn't it?
Yes, it's cute. Young and old enjoy seeing it and the playfulness of that sculpture. It's really a piece of art that started as you say, a utilitarian fountain, and is now really just a piece of art. But many of the fountains were utilitarian as well as decorative. For example, they had fountains where they were all it's real snazzy, but then they would have a drinking cup attached to the fountain by a chain. And you dip that drinking cup into the flow of water and have a sip of water. Thankfully, we've banned the shared drinking cups. But at the time, they were not only something to look at, but something that really would quench your thirst.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, Greg? And you've done more thinking about this than anybody I know, Greg Borzo. What is the reason behind it? Is not always, you know, ooh, I have a lot of money and I'm an altruist and I want to make something pretty. Yes, some are decorative, but yes, some are also, you know, meant to enhance various buildings in which people might want to buy something. Don't you? True?
There are some that are in front of a condo building or a bank. That enhance the business, the appeal of the building, for sure. But some were put in just for the, quote, just for the sake of art and beauty. The Fountain of the Great Lakes next to the Art Institute, designed by Laredo Taft. He wanted to uplift society through through the beauty of his sculptures, and he really succeeds with the Fountain of the Great Lakes. It's moving.
You write about the sort of relatively recently, you know, within the last 30, 40 years, there was a real explosion of fountains around this town. What was the reason for that?
Well, Mayor Daley was the force behind it, and he wanted to make Chicago a little more like Paris.
Yeah.
And it was part of the same movement where he would plant more trees and have these wrought iron fences around parks and have more bakeries downtown. He really fell in love with Paris. He saw bike share working there. He wanted to bring bike share to Chicago. And so there was this movement, and we got about 20 new fountains in the 1999 to 2004 window. And people scoffed at them, said it won't make a difference, but they have. They've softened the city. They've made the city more livable.
Well, you make a really great point in your book, Chicago's Fabulous Fountains, Greg Borzo, and that is your website as well, GREGBORZO.com, that these...
Just, Rick, it's just G Borzo.
Oh, G. Just G Borzo. Well, if they put you, Google you, you'll find it. G Borzo,
okay,
at GBorzo.com, and you can buy his other books too. That these things, that the fountains really do enhance the physical environment of the city. And to my mind, you also make the case that they are, in the hustle and bustle of a place like Chicago, they are oases of peace. I'm not trying to be, you know, touchy-feely about this, but I really do believe that, and I think you do too, Greg, don't you?
Absolutely, sure. A place to relax, read. I mean, just think about it. At the base of the Aeon Tower, right there in the heart of the loop, there are six fountains that offer a variety of settings for people to just relax or have a bite to eat or visit with friends.
What do you have? I know it's like picking a favorite child. do you have a favorite fountain? If you could... I'm not going to say you. Do you have a favorite fountain? You must have a few, right?
I do, and it's awful hard to pick even a few. But let's just say it's almost the 4th of July here. So let's go with the 4th of July fountain because my favorite fountain changes a lot. It depends on where I'm at, which fountain I'm sitting next to. But we're near the 4th of July, so... How about the Independence Square Fountain on the west side at Douglas and Independence Boulevards?
Mm.
It features children playing with fireworks.
Yeah.
There are a young boy and girl holding up Roman candles. And when the fountain opened in 1902, those flows of water were colored red, so they looked like they were blasting off fireworks. So that, you know, that's so un-PC by today's standards that it's kind of fun.
Well, also, you know, I wish the... Could you describe for the listeners, Greg Borzo, the old Olson Rug waterfall, where it was, what it was. I remember it. It vanished in the 1970s, but boy, in its time, that was some... I guess it does qualify as a fountain, but my God, that was something that, you know, it looks like it's from the middle of Wisconsin, didn't it?
Well, in fact, a lot of the limestone was brought down from Wisconsin, and some of the trees they brought in from Wisconsin, too. So it was a bit of Wisconsin in Chicago. In fact, it was called the Bohemian Dells.
Uh-huh.
Because a lot of Bohemians lived around the area where the fountain was located at Diversey and Crawford. And the fountain was built for the employees of the Olson Rug Company.
Yeah, yeah.
Local residents were free. The public was free to come and sit on the lawn there and enjoy this rushing waterfall, this rushing water of a fountain, and the surrounding grounds. And they also often had a program or a show there to enhance that. So what a wonderful thing Olson Rug did for the community. And what a loss, you know, when it was taken out.
Well, one of my,
with a parking lot.
One of my favorite, yeah, never good to lose a waterfall to a parking lot. In your book, Chicago's Fabulous Fountains, one of my favorite chapters is Chapter 7, Forgotten Fountains, in which the aforementioned Olson Rug Fountain is there. That is had to be, on your part, a very conscious choice. There are enough fountains to fill the book, but you really do, you're a historian, and I think it was very important for you to note these fabulous fountains that no longer exist. True?
Absolutely, because it's sad to say that we probably have lost as many fountains over our history as exist today in the city, and some of them were remarkable. There was one sitting in Pioneer Court.
I know. Right, I remember. Got it right next to the Tribune Tower. I remember that well.
Yeah, it was. It had the names of 25 of our pioneers.
Yeah.
Around the base of the fountain, and it was a great place for people to come and sit and have lunch, and then made it definitely made people think about, you know, who was Philip Armour?
Sure.
Who was De Sable and these other pioneers?
Why did that vanish?
I really don't know. It was in disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
like that whole plaza has been in disrepair, I think, since they put it up.
It's been back and forth, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has.
But maybe it was embarrassing, too, that the 25 pioneers they selected, were 24 of them were male. And they even misspelled the name of Pierre Point de Sable, father of Chicago. They just misspelled his name.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
Perhaps they wanted to correct the record.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why did the fountain vanish? It vanished for shame. 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 What do you think, Greg, before I let you go? And again, the book is Chicago's Fabulous Fountains. You can go to the website, GBORZO.com. To learn more about this, you can go to any bookstore and get this, and also see the beautiful, beautiful photography by Julia Thiel, and a foreword by Jeffrey Baer, and a preface by Deborah Shore, and a really, really nice kind of urban cover. What do you think now, as the leading expert on this element aspect of Chicago? What's the future of fountains in this town?
I hope it will be greater and more enhanced than ever. Perhaps this book will shine a light on these fountains that have been overlooked. Perhaps we'll learn from other cities that do some fun things like run fountains all winter.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the fact that we have four fountains with a direct link to the World's Columbian Exposition will get people excited about fountains, because they're excited about Devil in the White City and the forthcoming movie based on that book. And maybe they'll want to go out and seek out these four fountains with the link to the fair. So I see energy building behind these precious gems that dot our city.
Well, and one of the great things you've done, and I don't know how, there is another website called Chicago's Fabulous Fountains.com the publisher's website that has a map. Can you, when you appear and do signings and stuff, you give these maps away, don't you, Greg?
That's right. It's a four color map, 11 by 17.
They're beautiful, too.
It lists 40 fountains that people would be surprised to go and discover and learn about. And so I'm on a mission here. I want people to see these fountains, appreciate them. And so I give out the map, and people are grabbing them quickly, I tell you, at events and tours that I give. So I hope that helps.
So those tours, you just go to gborzo.com, right? And they can avail themselves of your tours and stuff.
Yes, tours that I give for the History Museum or the Chicago Cycling Club or different organizations are listed there, yes.
Greg, you're the best. This book, I'm glad we could talk to the listeners to After Hours, because you did. It should be on every single person's Chicago bookshelf, because no matter how well you think you know Chicago, as they say, you ain't seen nothing yet until you've seen this book. And the great thing is, you look at the last 2 days and the upcoming holiday, what a wonderful way to wander the city, you know, to take...
And with the heat we have, you go to Crown Fountain today and you just see kids playing in that water. It's fabulous.
See, one of the things, before I let you go, one of the great things about Crown Fountain, I think, is its democratic nature, that when you go there, and I often go there just to sit and watch, you have kids in that fountain and adults, people from the Gold Coast, wading in the water with people from Englewood, people from Lake Forest, sharing an urban space with people from, you know, less rarefied suburbs. I think it's one of the great democratics. It doesn't cost a cent either, and I think it's one
there
of the great democratic spaces in this town. And I think, in a way, any fountain can be that, even the most modest little fountain, because there's something about that shared experience. Maybe there's even something healing about water, but I think they're really democratic spaces. They're just there, ladies and gentlemen. Greg, I love this book. I really love the book, Chicago's Fabulous Fountains. And
great to hear.
And you're the best. You're one of Chicago's great historians. And this one, the more people that buy it, because it's a revelation, because no one has ever done this kind of book before, and no one, I don't care how well they think they know Chicago, knows half of these fountains. So congratulations again, Greg.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Always, always fun to talk to you. Go to GBORZO.com for all sorts of information. We will be right back after some commercials. Welcome back. It is my pleasure to have in here for about the next 45 minutes my old friend, colleague, person I greatly, greatly admire, not for his... God, we used to play basketball together.
Man, old friend as in long time.
Yes, in long time. Yeah. And we both walked slower than we used to. Lloyd Sachs is one of the best writers of his generation here in Chicago. And that would be my generation, too. And you would have seen his byline in The Reader and the Sun-Times and elsewhere. It is now on the cover of a book, T-Bone Burnett, A Life in Pursuit. Do not let the picture of Mr. Burnett on the cover scare you, as it did me. I, of course, knew who he was, but the depth that Lloyd expresses in this book made him incredibly accessible and even more mysterious. Is that, am I crazy, Lloyd, or what?
Not at all. I mean, T-Bone is a walking enigma, you know, in many ways, and has been for the last, for his 40 years in the business. I mean, he's full of contradictions. He's like a real intellectual who has to deal with all these, slick producers.
Non-intellectuals, yeah.
He's always attacking the industry for its idiotic, whether it comes to denying artists their fair share of the proceeds, or he hates MP3s. He's tried to launch kind of a recording revolution. He loves the old analog sound and has been working, apparently, on some new delivery system which will shock the world. There's a lot of P.T. Barnum and T-Bone. So
he's also wonderfully, and I think somewhat wildly, opinionated, too. I mean, as you're displaying here in your book, and early on page 4, you say Burnett is part Don Quixote, charging the digital windmills in his quest to restore analog truth, and part Southern politician crossing palms with hyperbolic play money. This is Lloyd's writing, too. He's such a good writer. He says that Justin Timberlake is, quote, the closest we have to Bing Crosby, claims Mandolin Chris Thiel, who's taken over, what's his name, show, right?
Perry Garrison Companion, Keeler,
is the Louis Armstrong of his time, and that calls Alison Krauss the one, just as Ray Charles was the one. You had interviewed him over the years, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And admired him.
Yeah, I mean, as an artist, as a producer, and also as a just a great guy. I mean, he's really a delight to be around. He's very, very upbeat in person. And as acerbic as he is in his views about culture and about, you know, I mean, this is a, I think I say, use this term, he was a real radical hiding in plain sight because, like Bob Dylan, I mean, he really was devoted to dissembling all these lies that we have about the forces that be and all of the false reality, which is really coming home to roost lately.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, he was on that case a long time ago, and his songs, his early songs, you know, he was a singer and songwriter, many people don't know.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that. He is greatly admired for his songwriting, but I had no idea that he had had a relatively couple decade long, I knew he played on Dylan's Rolling Thunder tour.
Right. He was a guitarist on the Rolling Thunder tour. And from that tour, he and two other guys formed a band called the Alpha Band.
Right, right, right.
Which really was very much motivated by their religious beliefs. And he is just basically, you know, for a long period of time, he was considered really one of the best songwriters in the country.
Do you think, I get a sense that, I don't get a sense, this guy is so wonderfully enigmatic to me, that he did not, he was dropped from a record, I mean, even with greatly admired, his stuff didn't sell.
Right, and that's one of the conundrums that he always faced, was that he was never commercially successful.
But he did, I get a sense, too. I mean, you do the great, that he wanted that.
Oh, yeah.
No question, right?
He made no bones about it, that he was, you know, disappointed that he wasn't successful on the level of a Warren Zevon or mm-hmm. Jackson Browne or some other people in L.A. But he's such a... such is his artistry and his honesty as an artist that he never really compromised his art to become popular.
Yeah.
Do
you think, as someone who knows everything he's ever done, do you think he needed to compromise in order to become popular? Do you think if he had kept at it that might have happened or no?
You know, it's interesting because his recording career has certain examples where he went in and he really tried to, very self-consciously, he was tweaking the production and he was just out of a kind of really insecurity, he was trying to change the music so it would come across in a more accessible way. But, you know, that's like saying, you know, that Dylan, you know, could have become a huge commercial success if he had tailored his songs more to the mainstream audience.
Right.
T-Bone has just, he's an original, and his songs were very surreal and very pointed, and really, I mean, there's a spiritual undercurrent to not only his songs, but his life and his career.
Yeah.
Or actually, I should say, his not a career, because he doesn't like using the word career.
I'm going to read a portion of you, sort of, this book sort of begins. But you really like him, don't you?
I do like him, yeah. And you know what else? All of the people around him, I mean, some people that I really, really respect and like as people like Roseanne Cash, and the singer-songwriter and producer Joe Henry, and, you know, Justin Timberlake, among others. You know, he's very much adored by most of the artists he works with. And it's really telling to me that he is still working and assigning things to artists, musicians he worked with 40 years ago when he was coming up in Fort Worth.
Wow.
You know, nobody maintains connections like that in this industry over such a long period of time.
We are going to, so that those of you who don't know T-Bone Burnett, and the nickname was a nickname from childhood, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is not something he came up with as a, you know, stage name or something.
No, he got a sort of attack by some blues artist down in Texas who thought he was trying to rip off T-Bone Walker, who was a real icon of the blues from Texas. And for a while, T-Bone actually dropped the hyphen. Actually, for a while, he called himself J. Henry Burnett and didn't call himself T-Bone at all. But then he came back around, but he dropped the hyphen.
Because he was going to get beat up by some blues guys in Texas. He was born in St. Louis and grew up in Texas. And Lloyd Sachs is in the studio to talk about his it's really an amazing story, because it was so revelatory to me. I sort of knew who this guy was, but A Life in Pursuit is a fabulous read. It is a kind of, what shall I call this, a kind of critical biography. Is that a good way to put it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It is not.
It's not like, then he dated this guy and then he got drunk with George Clooney.
I think some people were actually regard it or expecting this to be a straight. It's not a straight bio. It's more of a critical appreciation with biographical content.
Yeah, that's what I consider a revelatory critical biography. It's not some kind of tell-all People magazine thing. When we come back, Lloyd will select something. Lloyd will select something, and Lise will play a sample of something, and then we'll talk about his music. And then also, he may be most famous for, do you think he is most famous for the sort of orchestrating the soundtrack for George Clooney's movie Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, yeah, that was the one that made him, a phenomenon in American culture.
Okay, because he sort of invented a kind of what has become, what is it called, Americana or
a
genre?
Yeah, I'm not sure he invented it, because the strains of Americana were present back with the Byrds and Gram Parsons.
Right.
But absolutely, in the wake of Oh Brother, this whole roots music movement really sprung to life and and really led to Americana.
No question. I also want to talk. He is a legendary, legendary producer, and Lloyd does a remarkable job. I want to talk about his visit to L.A., but in Chapter 13 of his book, T-Bone Burnett, A Life in Pursuit, it's called Hitman, where he really gets into what it takes. If I were to ask you out there, hey, what's a record producer do? What would you think? They push the button. They say, you'll think of Will Ferrell from the Saturday Night, more cowbell. That's not what a producer does. We'll talk about that chapter, too. We'll be right back. Talking to Lloyd Sachs until 1:45. We may go all the way to 11, and then we will get Lisa's new career in next week somewhere, because this guy, he has written about T-Bone Burnett. The book is T-Bone Burnett, A Life in Pursuit.
I do charge overtime.
It's all right. I have 14.
But you guys are.
I have $14 and get you some water or something.
All right.
Get you some water here, because I want to read some stuff. I also want you listeners to hear what Lloyd might like us to hear to sort of explain who. Let's hear something now. Pick a song.
Sure.
And set it up and tell. I'm really curious, because the George Clooney movie. He also did the soundtrack for Cold Mountain, right?
For Cold Mountain, and also for True Detective, the HBO series.
That's right.
And which was like just this astounding jukebox, where there was something every 10 seconds coming out of radios and car shops. It really surprises me that, as well-known as T-Bone Burnett is, and you can't really read a reference to him without it saying the legendary T-Bone Burnett.
No question.
I was amazed at how many people were unaware of that aspect of his. That he was a great singer and songwriter, and it sort of became part of my mission here to expose that. But, you know, in terms of songs, I can absolutely tell you which song he had me at. You know, we all have songs that really make us lifelong fans of that artist. And this one was way back from around 1980 from his first bona fide T-Bone Burnett album, which was recorded, the demos were recorded during the making of Heaven's Gate up in Montana.
Movie disaster.
Where he was hanging out there with his buddies, Stephen Bruton and Chris Christopherson, who was obviously the star of the movie. But this song, you know, we can talk a lot about T-Bone's brilliance as a social commentator and as a kind of a spiritual sender, but he's also a great pop artist.
Wow.
And this is the song. It's from his first album, Truth Decay, and the song is called Boomerang. And if this isn't the hookiest song you've heard in 10 years, then I'll pay you that money for the overtime. Let's hear some Boomerang.
Thanks, Lise.
Like a boomerang.
I love that song. I can see why. I wish I'd known that song.
Oh, well, you know, just his lyrics can be so off the wall, and these narratives he creates, I mean, can be hilarious and cutting at the same time. But it's, you know, it's important to note that, you know, the influence of the Beatles was very strong on young T-Bone growing up in Fort Worth, Texas, where when the British invasion hit, a lot of the local bands were more drawn towards the rough and rowdy stuff of the Rolling Stones and bands like that. But he was, you know, once and, you know, forever a real pop guy
experimenter. That is a pop song. That is a great, great song. I'm going to keep Lloyd here. Even the overtime check will arrive. Maybe Governor Rauner can figure out how to pay him for this. Because there's just too much to talk about, and I do want to hear some more music, too. I'm going to read also from Lloyd's book, especially about how Lloyd even came to write this book. I'm assuming that the idea popped into your head before this fabulous encounter outside the Vic Theater.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I knew T-Bone a little bit and had talked to him a lot of times, and I'd actually done a long cover story on him for No Depression magazine, which was the lamented Roots magazine. And, you know, I'd interviewed him at various times for the Sun Times, for his own stuff, for the stuff he produced his wife at the time, Sam Phillips, who's another brilliant artist. And so at that point, he had called me up and asked me to come up to the sound check for what was his first
album in like 15 years.
Yeah, his first album and his first tour in forever.
Yeah.
And
after the news, I will read what happened at that thing, and then even Ravinia and a little after Ravinia is very interesting, too. I'm spending this whole hour with Lloyd Sachs. His book is T-Bone Burnett, A Life in Pursuit. You should buy it. We'll also hear more music, and you'll get some insight from the book, which is very insightful about what it means to be a producer in the crazy, crazy. Welcome back. Rick Cogan with his pal Lloyd Sachs, the author of T-Bone Burnett, A Life in Pursuit, a critical biography of the performer. You just heard a song called Boomerang. Now I'm in love with this guy and think he's a great singer-songwriter, and that's a very catchy tune. Lloyd saw him in 2006 outside of the Vic Theater with the Sun-Times photographer doing a piece about him. He writes, I had visited him after one or two shows in the Windy City and met him for lunch in Los Angeles. As enthusiastic a listener as he is a talker, he laughs at all your jokes, making you feel like you're the sharpest tack in the box. But I'm just reading this to you because I wanted to show you what a great narrative writer Lloyd is. A bookish Lenny Bruce, he's a spritzer who fills the air with quotations from literary figures, philosophers, and jazz greats, not to show off, but rather because he just can't help himself, and also one senses because he feels a personal need to elevate words and ideas at a time in our culture when they are taking it on the chin from visual images. Okay, Lloyd approaches him then in the summer of 2008 to propose writing a book about him. Lloyd says he did not pick the best place. He picked backstage at Ravinia following a concert. He made the pitch and then writes, in subsequent weeks and months, determined to sell him on the book directly rather than go through a guy in charge of his business affairs, I made numerous attempts to follow up on our Ravinia conversation. But he was never, this is so fascinating to me, he was never at the numbers he told me to call, and he didn't respond to my emails. I wasn't yet familiar with his Houdini-like proficiency for disappearing. First of all, that's just great writing.
Thank you. That totally
captures the guy. And there's another great line that I read to Lloyd off. I'm reading stuff to Lloyd off the air that you people should be hearing. You write in here talking about his first exposure to music coming from his parents and their great record collection, but also that the radio was his gateway to a world of places. You talked about it, the Beatles' influence on this kid. Religion also had a huge influence, as did golf on this young man. But when he went to... Talk about his first visit to Los Angeles. I found that chapter really interesting, Lloyd.
Well, you know, T-Bone, obviously, at some point he was going to have to leave Fort Worth.
Oh, sure.
Where, you know, people should know, he owned his own recording studio by the time, just after he graduated high school.
Yeah.
It was downstairs from an established radio station where a lot of hits... Yeah, there were a lot of hits made in the studio in the old days, but he turned it into his own thing. But he, the lure of L.A. was too strong, and he went there, and there were all kinds of people that he could play with, and you know,
it was like really 67
of a high level. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it was. But he, you know, T-Bone is still he's a Texan. He's through and through. He's a Texan. He lived a long time in L.A., and now he spends a lot of the year in Nashville. But he's a Texas guy, and he never really fit in with the whole, you know, L.A., if you remember L.A. in the 70s, there was, what do you think of the Eagles?
Yeah, right.
He, not a favorite band of his. You know, Linda Ronstadt, that whole country rock thing. And so he really, to establish himself there, it took some doing. And, when Dylan tabbed him to go on Rolling Thunder, that was a break that really enabled him to kind of overcome his outsider status in L.A.
Yeah.
And one thing led to another, and he was not only recording albums but also producing people as well.
How exactly did that happen? Again, I mentioned it before, if you were listening, about chapter 13, one of my favorite chapters in a book filled with my favorite chapters about, Bob Johnson, Jerry Wexler, John Hammond, the whole nature of being a record producer. You do a great job. What is a record producer, Lloyd Sachs? What is a great record producer?
Well, you know, there are different definitions of record producers. There are guys like Daniel Lanois, who produced Dylan's album Time Out of Mind and Emmylou Harris's masterpiece Wrecking Ball, and who's a recording artist. And Daniel Lanois is considered a great producer, but in the sense where he imprints his own sound on the artist.
Phil Spector-like?
Phil Spector had the wall of sound of Phil Spector.
Yeah.
So there are certain producers who are identified with their sound. There are other producers who, like, you know, the Beatles' George Martin, forever identified with his ingenuity and his ability. I mean, he was splicing up tape and stuff.
Yeah.
And T-Bone, what has made T-Bone really special is that he combines all of these aspects of a producer. I mean, he brings to every project, he'll bring in like dozens and dozens of song suggestions to the artists he produces. He's very much about sound and about, you know, over the years he actually devised his own kind of bottom heavy, really reverberant sound, which you can hear to extremely great effect on Raising Sand by Robert Plant and Alison Krauss. But, you know, the more I've thought about it, and I hope this came across in the book, with T-Bone, it's as much about state of mind as it is about any kind of technique in the studio. Mm. He has this kind of, he is in this stuff for the value of the music and the moment. There's a real kind of, in a non-religious sense, there's kind of a spiritual aspect to what he does. It's a serious undertaking that really looks to lift up everyone with the results. And one of the reasons that artists like him so much is that it's so relaxed working with him. He'll set up like a little living room thing with couches and chairs and lamps and stuff. And he has this incense. I don't know if he still uses it. There's this Peruvian incense he burns that supposedly has this great property for
creativity,
for inspiring creative thought and stuff. But he puts artists at ease. And that's not to say things have gone swimmingly with every artist
right.
he's ever
yeah,
produced.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, that's
yeah.
not the case. He's very strong-willed, and there are certain cases where it just hasn't worked out. But in
he
a large...
One of the interesting things, Lloyd, is that he was not... He ditched your phone calls. He was never enthusiastic, I don't think, about having you write a book, but he didn't try to produce you either. I mean, he didn't technically sit for, you know, 20 hours of
right.
interviews, but he didn't cut off access to everybody else.
He was very generous about that, and I'm grateful to him because there was no one around him that I couldn't talk to, including Sam Phillips, who was married to him, and he produced 7 of her albums. You know, just about anybody I wanted to talk to, I could. And in the end, I mean, he was also very helpful in getting me some photos for the book,
yeah.
which was all on me. I mean,
sure.
you know.
Yeah, University Press.
University
oh, yes.
Press,
yes.
you end up having to pay for a lot
oh,
of
yeah.
these expenses. But he, you know, and that's, you know, aside from everything else, it saved me a bunch of money.
Sure.
But he was great about that.
So what do you think? What do you think his... You know, I think in here there are a few people hint at it. His reluctance to fully engage this critical biography had something to do with, you know, a fatalism of sorts.
You know, it's hard to say. He's a very complicated guy. But,
no question.
But he, I mean, one thing, he doesn't like dwelling on the past. He just felt like, you know... Sam Phillips was talking about his whole thing about mortality,
right,
where he doesn't
right.
have all that much time left. You know, he's pushing 70 now. And so he didn't want to relive all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And there may have been, you know, chapters in his life he just didn't want to talk about. You know, there's just, as all grown people, you know, there's certain things
oh, you're telling me. Are you
he's
kidding?
Sensitive
yeah.
about. But he... He basically
didn't impede you in any way.
He did not impede me in any way. And, you know, we would exchange every once in a while. There were just these little haiku-like emails, you know, where I knew that I had to get in there fast and ask a question because once I got to question 2, he disappeared
into
ether.
You would vanish again.
into
you would
the,
vanish
yeah.
again. We'll be back with Lloyd after a short commercial break. Lloyd Sachs. You can go to Lloyd has a website. Lloyd, I'll tell you a great story about Fred Holstein and a website. LLOYDSACHS.com. That's one way to get the book. Walking in a bookstore is another way. Going to Amazon or any of the various websites that have books. When we come back, we'll talk about T-Bone's...
Or, you know, I'll just bring it over.
He will. He'll bring it over later tonight. I think his wife's out of town. He can do whatever you want.
I don't have a bike, but I'll get one and,
he will deliver
and ride it over.
He will deliver it. There are bikes all over this city. We'll talk about T-Bone's collaboration with Steppenwolf and talk a little bit more about what Lloyd's going to do after the success of this book. We'll be right back. Sadly, only about 10 more minutes with Lloyd Sachs, the author of, most recently, T-Bone Burnett, A Life in Pursuit, which is a fascinating book about not just a influential musician, producer, singer, songwriter, but about the business itself. That's the other thing I like about it, Lloyd. I mean, the backdrop is you're very good on this. He worked with Steppenwolf, didn't he?
He did for a period of time. You know, during the Rolling Thunder tour with Bob Dylan, Sam Shepard, the great playwright, was on hand supposedly to write the script for Dylan's film, Rinaldo and Claro,
yeah.
his 4-hour or 8-hour opus. And they ended up working on some stuff together. T-Bone and his longtime musical partner, a horn player from down in Texas, did the music for Mother Courage at Steppenwolf. And T-Bone worked on, he wrote the a new score for one of Shepard's plays. And so for a while, he was, and he also performed, remember the Traffic series at Steppenwolf,
there
was kind of interdisciplinary.
Sure.
T-Bone and Shepard did a show there that was kind of memorable. And then they, I think they went to Ireland together without Shepard, but doing the same show with the late, great Martha Lavey. I can't believe she's
gone.
Same here. And John Mahoney, I think.
And he seemed to like, I mean, he's, in the book, he seemed to get the sense that he enjoyed, you know, the theater music collaboration.
Well, it took him, I think it was.
Yeah,
it
took him out of the business he hates.
It took him out of himself, though. He was kind of in a funk as a songwriter. And I think, from what I heard, Shepard kind of brought him on board to have him write these songs for The Tooth of Crime. That really, and just T-Bone, the whole being part of that community really, and T-Bone has always thrived on being part of communities from Rolling Thunder to, he had this ensemble that played Steppenwolf that he called Void, which had the great Gillian Welch and, some Nashville musicians and Sam Phillips. And he's always great as part of a larger thing. And I think that's
interesting.
That's part of his artistic personality, is it's rarely just about him.
Yeah.
It's always about the larger circle he's in. And
which is also probably one of the reasons he is not, that everybody listening is, and, oh, my God, he doesn't have that star complex.
Yeah.
And you make that point eminently clear. In the book, what's next for him, do you think? I mean,
Well, you know, he's slowed down a little bit in terms of album producing, although he has a really nice album by the Scottish singer, Irish, Imelda May.
Mm-hmm.
He produced her. But he's been involved in this really ambitious project down in Nashville. There was a minor league park, former minor league park called Greer Stadium, where the Nashville Sound played, and that has been abandoned. And he's involved in this, billion-dollar, multi-million-dollar development project to turn it into this whole kind of public open space and housing and with a cultural center.
Oh,
how
interesting.
And, I mean, he says this is his baby and this will be his legacy. And, it'll be great to see it get off the ground.
Do you know if he's read the book?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm really not sure. I hope he has.
Well, I got to tell you something. I'm not T-Bone Burnett. I mean, I'll tell you that right now. But if he reads this book and is not eminently pleased with your writing and your critical appraisal of him, then he's nuts. I mean, he may well be nuts.
Well, that could be the case anyway.
He may well be nuts.
As well as the case with me.
But you, you, my friend, you have to be pretty proud of this book, aren't you?
I am. It was a labor of love, I have to say. I mean, it's something I brought a lot of, serious. I mean, It really was something, just living with this music for a year or a little over a year.
Yeah.
I mean, how great was that? Listening to all these albums again by, Jimmy Dale Gilmore and Gillian Welch.
And also interviewing, having the access or the to interview people you also admire and interview people about someone you admire. It's a lovely way to spend time.
Yeah, and, a large percentage of people really admire him. I have to tell you, this one artist, I had the, you know, I had to collect some blurbs for the book.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm really happy. I mean, I got some really nice ones from Rodney Crowell and the writer Holly George Warren and the producer Don Was. But I had this, actually, I think it was my wife who put this in my head, so I'll blame her, that I'm not going to name this artist, but there's a guy in Americana who's become a big star. And I thought it would be cool to have him provide a blurb just as a kind of bridge between generations and maybe even as an acknowledgement of T-Bones. And I didn't get further than his manager, who, to make a long discussion short, said, you know, not everyone is drinking the T-Bone Kool-Aid.
Is that right? Wow.
Oh, okay.
Can I use that on the jacket?
Yeah, right. So, you know, not everybody loves him. And, you know, it's and like I said, to some people, he represents the establishment. And which
seems so funny to me.
In some ways, it's true, but
in so many ways, from your wonderful book, to me, in the music business, he's kind of a radical in the music business.
You know, he's an activist.
Yeah,
you know, he's appeared before Congress. You know, testifying on behalf of artists, and you know, railing against the inequities of the world we live in terms of streaming music and stuff. And like I said, he hates digital sound. And he's lambasted the industry on a number of occasions.
Yeah, he is. Lloyd, you have really captured. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Captured a fascinating guy. I would have read the book anyway because I'm a friend of yours. But He is really something. This picture on the front scares me. I mean, the picture on the front, he's holding a guitar. He really scares me. But he's also like a 5-handicap golfer. And there are all sorts of aspects of his life. We'll have to come back on.
Oh, sure. That'd be great.
Keep me posted on what he's doing in Nashville. It's great to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Again, oh, don't be silly. It's long overdue. T-Bone Burnett. T with no period there. A Life in Pursuit. The author is Lloyd Sachs. You can go to his website. It's LLOYDSACHS.com.
You can also go to TboneBurnettBook.com.
Oh, okay.
It's more geared towards a book, obviously. But I should point out the publisher is the University of Texas
Press.
Yes,
and they did a nice job. It's a handsome book.
Really good people.
They are good people. So are you, Lloyd Sachs.